a general logic model for any implementation research study. Makes sense, I think, to some extent, because it's generated a lot of evidence for certain behavior change strategies, you know, things like that, that are at kind of like a micro level. What it lacks is the idea that people have feelings that are doing this work, and they have assumptions and beliefs and values. And I've just come to the conclusion at all times, like anytime I'm in a meeting, just to stay curious, because every time you think, why is this happening? Or I thought we talked about this, and you're having these implementation barriers come up, stay curious, because the truth of the matter is you haven't even touched the surface of what it is that you thought you knew that you definitely don't actually know.
This is Mission to Scale, a podcast that reveals the tools, mindsets, and strategies that organizations and funders need to maximize their impact. Because the world's biggest problems need solutions at scale. I'm your host, Dan Beredovitz, founder of Spring Impact. Applying research-based evidence into programs is not always straightforward. There's often a disconnect between what we know from research and our ability to successfully apply that knowledge into practice. The job of implementation scientists is to study the factors contributing to this gap. Today's guest is Alison Metz, a professor and director of implementation practice at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I was excited to chat with Alison because her research has been helpful in supporting organizations at Spring Impact. In this conversation, we talk about the field of implementation science, how it's broadening its scope in some ways, while remaining reductionist in others. Alison explains why she thinks that successful implementation should pay more attention to context and relationships. On the show, she also shares her advice to those wishing to use implementation science to achieve greater results. Alison encountered implementation science about 15 years ago, when the field was just starting to take off.
The reason I became interested in it was just in work that I was doing supporting implementation efforts. You know, you start to realize that there's a lot more to it than simply offering training. And that there's lots of issues around capacity and buy-in. And I started to think about, you know, some of those issues and how it is we could make sure that anyone that could benefit from a service could in fact receive it. And so from there, became interested in the field of implementation science and moved over to the National Implementation Research Network, where I was for many years and directed that group. And we really, for the most part, really specialized in the use of different implementation and scaling frameworks to support the use of evidence-informed and evidence-based practices at scale to achieve impact.
Alison spent over a decade working at the National Implementation Research Network. She then moved on to become a professor and director of implementation practice at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. There she started a group called the Collaborative for Implementation Practice.
We're really seeking to be a real force around a practice-informed implementation research agenda, one that really is informed by those most affected by implementation. My interests have really broadened into really thinking about the practice of implementation. That led me to kind of two different areas. One is thinking about the workforce and the competencies, the skills that it really takes to effectively support implementation efforts. There'd been a lot of work done on competencies for implementation researchers, but there had been a lot less work done on competencies for those who are really on the ground supporting implementation efforts. And then I also became really interested in the relational aspect of implementation. So kind of taking a look at theories, models, frameworks, and strategies that are used a lot in the field of implementation science. Many of them don't mention building relationships or developing trust. or addressing issues of power in the work. And I realized in order for us to really center equity in our work and center kind of the human experience in our work, we had to get really clear about the roles of relationships. And so over the last few years, I've spent a lot of time on that topic and write about that a lot and have a couple of research projects specifically related to trust building.
Very interesting, because I always assumed implementation science was by definition practical. Implementation is doing things, but listening to you speaking, it actually sounds like implementation science might have fallen afoul of the propensities of academia, which is to study but not necessarily put into practice in a way that really leads to impact.
Wow, right. So I do want to acknowledge what you said, and I think affirm it from my perspective. There is a lot of conversation in the field about this disconnect between implementation research and implementation practice, which is probably the greatest of all ironies, because the field of implementation science was developed to bridge research and practice, but we've kind of got caught up in the same challenges, which is our own research to build evidence around implementation strategies has, I think, been a bit disconnected from, again, kind of work on the ground and really kind of applied settings.
Next, Alison lays out a traditional model used for implementation research studies.
A general logic model for any implementation research study. It's going to talk about the determinants, so barriers and facilitators to implementation. So what are the determinants? What are the strategies you're going to use to address those determinants? What mechanisms of change do those strategies produce? And then what outcomes result from that? So just generally speaking, if you have a determinant that you'd feel like people are not bought in, you have a lack of buy-in, right? That's an implementation determinant, and you develop a strategy to address that buy-in. And maybe that strategy is, this is so simple and it really wouldn't be something that would be great to choose, might be additional training. And the idea being that you think the mechanism of change is that the more exposure, the more motivated people will get, and the motivation becomes the mechanism. And then that mechanism of deeper motivation leads you to the implementation outcome of greater acceptability of the intervention, right? That's essentially, you know, if you were to kind of draw a straight line, every implementation research study that looks at kind of determinants and strategies and mechanisms is going to look at that.
Alison's approach to implementation science draws from this model, but it's also multidisciplinary.
I do think research evidence matters, but I think how we develop it is also what matters. Who we engage in that development and the choices around that really matter as well. And I think the field is growing and considering a lot of those other aspects, but I think there are other fields like co-production or action research, you know, other participatory methods that people use. I think that the field of URE, use of research evidence, I think I pull methods from all of those fields, and I think that I'm influenced by people who have critical perspectives on how we develop evidence, how we make choices about the evidence we use. And 15 years ago or even 10 years ago, it just would have been about the scaling of evidence-based programs. And I'm not down on evidence-based programs. I think that they have an important role, but I think they're one puzzle. And I think that now people would start to think about how you integrate co-creation and implementation science, like how you do that work, how you lift up the relational aspects of the work, and that we don't focus on the technical aspects of implementation, like fidelity assessments and things like that. Not that we don't want to do that, but we don't want to do it at the expense of people feeling safe, that there being a learning culture. All the things that come from other fields that seem to matter an enormous amount.
So I cooled on random control trials, RCTs, when I saw a small nonprofit that I was working with get a huge and important study for them. But then they lost some funding halfway through. And they were told that if they didn't continue to deliver in exactly the same way with the same fidelity, that the study would not be useful, they wouldn't have the evidence, and then that would lead to them not being able to get funding in the future. So they just managed not to go bankrupt. But even worse than that, really, was that it was quite clear after 6 months that the program needed to change quite significantly in a couple of different ways as it was scaling. Because the random control trial was fixed in how it was measuring, it wasn't able to do that. They had to keep delivering with fidelity. So I'm interested in this tension between fixed programs and actually helping. And I can see, as you talk about research, essentially the sort of definition of implementation science is research of implementation versus the practice. How actually, if you're researching and then you see the practice can be improved, you kind of want to improve the practice, but then it messes up your ability to measure because the ground is shifting under your feet, albeit hopefully in a positive way. So there's a tension there. Is that a tension that you'd see? Is it something that you try and manage?
There's always going to be the tension between kind of fidelity and ongoing improvement. But I do think that there is, I do think there's been a shift over the last decade or so where there's been a true focus on the fact that implementation survives and thrives in a learning culture. So the idea that we constantly want to be taking in information and pivoting our implementation efforts. And that may lead to modifications in both intervention fidelity and implementation fidelity. So there's something that you're implementing, the what, and that has fidelity, you know, whether that's a curriculum, some sort of intervention that has core components. And, you know, during COVID, we saw that, you know, the idea that, oh, we have to pivot. This is a home-based program, but we're not going in people's homes, right? And so the idea of seeing all of those adjustments happening incredibly quickly because of COVID. And then there's adjustments that you make to implementation protocols. And I think it's really important that those types of adaptations that are made during projects are inevitable. And I think that they need to just be really well documented. And there's so much research on that, that adaptations are typically fine if they're made intentionally, and we then study whether or not the adaptation had its intended benefit. Adaptations don't work when they're made in a haphazard way, or we don't kind of follow through on. So I think that tension exists, but I do think people are moving towards a little bit more fluidity. Like, I think of fidelity as critical, yet dynamic.
Hey, Mission to Scale listeners, I need a favor. If the show has helped you in any way, can you share this episode with a friend or colleague? Maybe it's someone who likes listening to good podcasts in their downtime or on their way to work. All you have to do is copy the link in this episode and send it over with a, hey, you might want to check out Mission to Scale. To keep providing the show, we need to build our audience. And if you haven't yet, please subscribe where you listen to your podcasts. Appreciate you for helping spread the word. And thank you for being part of the Mission to Scale community. Now back to the show. For Alison, it's important to consider how people feel and relate to one another when implementing evidence-based research.
There's all sorts of things that happen in projects that lend themselves to the kind of dynamism of implementation and are really hard to pin down. And that's the feedback loops, you know, the idea of people's feelings and affective responses to the implementation effort. And I've just come to the conclusion at all times, like anytime I'm in a meeting, just to stay curious. Because every time you think, why is this happening? Or I thought we talked about this, you know what I mean? Like, and you're having these implementation barriers come up, stay curious. Because the truth of the matter is you haven't even touched the surface of what it is that you thought you knew that you definitely don't actually know, you know, in terms of how people are feeling. And other fields have already done that work, right? Like systems theory, the iceberg model. If you think about implementation, for the most part, what we've studied over the years is above the waterline, right? It's structural. It's data collection activities, the number of meetings or the delivery of the training, you know, something we can see. And then as you kind of move below the waterline, we study that a bit less, right? Things that are kind of semi-explicit, like relationships, like power, who has power in this situation, who are the stakeholders. And then we don't study at all what's at the deep, deep bottom of that ocean, which are people's values. Systems theory should probably be used more around tailoring of implementation strategies. Because the strategies that we have are typically above the waterline, right? They're what we can see, observe, measure. Like if we're not tailoring strategies to form relationships, to build trust, to develop shared group models, mental models, it's very hard to move work forward and to sustain it. So I do think that's where these other disciplines like systems theory work come is so helpful. You know what I mean? Like you're running an implementation team and you know always that there's two things going on, what people are saying and what they're not saying.
Yeah.
And you have to understand that. I have so much interest in how do we research that? How do we build a workforce that knows when to kind of raise the heat and when not to say anything? You know what I mean? Like it takes a lot of skill to support implementation beyond frameworks.
In case you're unfamiliar with systems theory, it refers to the idea that behavior is influenced by a variety of factors that work together as a system. Such factors can include economic class, social settings, and family and friends. Alison began reflecting on how these impact implementation early in her career.
I've also spent a big chunk of my career being on the ground and like sitting in child welfare system offices and talking to practitioners and talking to middle managers and talking to parent advocates and just trying to understand how to take the knowledge from implementation science and really apply it in those ways. And I started to think a lot about how the voices of those people that do that work are honestly not that present in the field in some ways. And what I mean by that are in journal articles or at conferences. So I wanted to, in some ways, take a step back and start to write about that, to talk about that. So it's like we have an article coming out which is titled, Is There a Disconnect Between Implementation Research and Practice? And it's based on a lot of qualitative interviews we've done with individuals that do the work on the ground and kind of asking them about their own journeys and why does they make the choices they make. People who do this work talk endlessly about trust and relationships. They talk endlessly about the strategies they use to do that. And I just realized, oh, wow, that's interesting. We're not really measuring that, or we're not really talking about psychological safety on our implementation teams. And, you know, the idea that lots of people feel like they don't have a voice in implementation. And when you're trying to support implementation, you're trying to create a container for everybody to eventually develop a shared mental model. But how you get there, it's not a linear line, you know? I mean, there are times where I'm holding information that I think is needed to be shared to improve the effort, but I'm not sure I should share it just yet because I'm trying to build the confidence and the trust of a group that shared it with me. So just the idea of continuous improvement, it's a technical process, plan, do, study, act cycles, whatever you're using. But the truth of the matter is it's also an emotional process and a relational process that there's so much relational work in feedback loops and continuous improvement that's totally overlooked in the literature about how you make the decisions to pivot or not.
You talked a lot about implementation moving on in your mind from this mechanistic view to one which is more relational. Is that just you? Do we happen to have you on this podcast and that's what we're hearing? Or do you think that the whole space is moving in that direction?
I think if you look at Twitter, which is usually a bit of a gauge, I think there is a movement. I don't think it'll move away from kind of a mechanistic or even at times top-down design approach to the work. But I think there's space for that, because I think that that does develop a certain type of knowledge. And maybe some of that work, you know, remains, you know, important for certain types of research questions. But no, I think there's a lot of discussion about relationships, there's also a lot of discussion about leadership. I see more and more, like even some of the folks that you would think of, like Adam Grant or Brené Brown, you know, you kind of see folks in the field of implementation science kind of tweeting some of those things out more than you would have in the past. People are talking about concepts of resilience. You know, we just had a session on mitigating burnout in implementation last week. We had 1,100 people register.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think it's real. I think COVID and racial injustice and COVID shining a light on disparities in outcomes and just also people's general exhaustion with the last, you know, 2+ years. People are thinking about it differently. Not everyone will. But I do think that there's more of a conversation around empathy, vulnerability, authenticity, transparency, engagement. I think I'm seeing those words a lot more in the last 2 years than I've ever seen them in the work.
I asked Allison when practitioners should be engaging with an implementation scientist.
Probably the right answer to that question is when they're in kind of early days of defining the problem space and thinking about what they might want to do and doing that early needs assessment, things like that. But the truth is for me is that we need to be incredibly agile in the work, both from an implementation researcher and implementation support role, all the way down to, oh my God, this is not working out. And our funder is not happy, or we had 60% of our staff turnover last year, whatever it is. And we should be able to meet people where they are.
Wonderful. I must confess, as I'm hearing you speak to half a lifetime's of knowledge gained, hard won knowledge gained, I sort of think, oh my God, what do practitioners actually need to know? People listening to this podcast are likely to be leaders of organizations. So what do they need to know? Where would they start gaining that knowledge?
I would say that what people need to know is how we define problems is a very fateful choice. Because once we define the problem, we put a lot of energy and resources into trying to solve that problem. And whether that's a challenge that we're trying to pick an intervention for, or whether that problem is the barrier to implementation. And I think that we too often have misdiagnosed the actual problem. The most important thing we can do before we even start work is just to try and feel a little bit more certain about what we're actually doing and why we're doing it. The other thing I would say would be really obvious to you. I think that relationships matter. Everyone says that things move at the speed of trust. Implementation is no different than that. So how we develop relationships, who we bring to the table, how comfortable we are releasing authority and giving that authority to others to be able to make decisions, I think that matters a lot. And then I think the other thing I've learned is that values should really drive implementation decisions. I think when you have a clear set of values at the beginning and you develop those values with those most affected by implementation effort, whatever it is you're working on, that can be like a beacon in the work. I think we can save ourselves a lot of challenges later if we drive implementation by values. Not to say that I don't think that all the other stuff matters, using data for continuous improvement, you know what I mean? Developing really good communication protocols, conducting needs and strengths assessments. Absolutely. Fidelity matters. You know, all those things matter. But if I were to go for the kind of low-hanging fruit of what I think is make or break in some of the things I just said then.
When I first encountered implementation science, it tended to be a narrow discipline that took into account the technical aspects of implementation. I was pleased to hear how Allison's work has expanded to take into account wider systems considerations when implementing. I believe it's this ability to look beyond traditional models of implementation and examine how they can be improved that will create impact at scale. I hope this episode also inspired you to take a closer look at the multitude of social factors influencing your outcomes. If you've enjoyed this episode of Mission to Scale, check out Upstarts, a new podcast series by The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. Upstarts focuses on the stories of a diverse range of impact entrepreneurs spanning industries, interests, and influence. The series gets to the heart of the journey of an impact entrepreneur, looking into how they built their companies, what problems they're trying to fix, their impact so far, and their hopes for the future. What can we learn, and then action, from their experience? Thank you to our media partner, Alliance Magazine. If you like to stay connected with the latest news in global philanthropy, Mission to Scale listeners can get 50% off your first subscription by using the code SPRINGIMPACT at checkout. Visit alliancemagazine.org to find out more. That's it for today's episode. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss out on any of our episodes. And while you're there, I'd appreciate it if you could rate and give us a review. If you love Mission to Scale, I hope you recommend our show to a friend or colleague. Thanks so much for joining us, and I'll catch you all in the next episode. Mission to Scale is produced by Spring Impact and Human Group Media. If you want to learn more about our work at Spring Impact, visit springimpact.org and follow us at Spring Impact on Twitter.